wanna get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We run the crowd loud, this pumping rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want, we want, we want, we want, we want, we want, we want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. Peter Phillips will be back next week. Today's program, we look at the state of the free press in the U.S., media censorship, and the ongoing attacks on journalists. Award-winning and syndicated editorial cartoonist Ted Rall joins the program. He'll discuss his recent firing from the L.A. Times in a strange and twisted tale that looks at a 14-year-old jaywalking offense, the power of the police and police unions, their connection to the owners of the press, and the cover-up that continues as he fights for vindication. Ted Rall joins us for the hour to tell his story. Please stay with us.
Ritualized alibis, skies, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, far for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. Hypnotized by the master thief, combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you probably own it.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. Peter Phillips will be back next week. Today's program, we look at the state of the free press in the U.S., media censorship, and ongoing attacks on journalists. George Bernard Shaw once wrote, "All censorships exist to prevent anyone from challenging current conceptions and existing institutions. All progress is initiated by challenging current conceptions and executed by supplanting existing institutions. Consequently, the first condition of progress is the removal of censorship." There is the whole case against censorships in a nutshell. Well, today's program, we look at the problems of censorship, and we have a stellar guest who not only fights against it and calls it out, but has now been subject to it and victim to it. Our guest for the hour today is Ted Rall, twice the winner of the Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award and a Pulitzer Prize finalist. Ted Rall is a syndicated political cartoonist, opinion columnist, graphic novelist, and occasional war correspondent. For Seven Stories Press, he is an illustrator of the full-length comic Billionaires Ballot Bandits, How to Steal an Election in 9 Easy Steps, written by Greg Palast. He's also the author and illustrator of The Book of Obama and The Anti-American Manifesto. His most recent books are After We Kill You, We Will Welcome You Back as Honored Guests, and Snowden, the first book-length biography of Edward Snowden. From one of America's leading political minds and graphic artists, we welcome Ted Rall to the Project Censored Show. Ted Rall, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Mickey. It's a privilege.
Ted, at Project Censored, we've been writing for a long time about the state of the First Amendment, particularly the free press, and we, of course, focus on issues of censorship. But there are many different facets to this. Let's just open up by talking about some of your thoughts on the state of the free press in the U.S. and how you see it. And, of course, we're going to get into some details because you've actually been at the center of some of the issues of censorship as of late.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of a case study for what's right and what's wrong with the state of free media in the United States. I mean, the positive thing is that I've been able to deliver a fairly radical, by American mainstream standards, political analysis in my cartoons and in my books and columns in very mainstream outlets, big corporate media. Over a course of more than 20 years, I've had a very successful career and won some awards, as you mentioned earlier. And really, it's kind of remarkable what I've been able to get away with in that time. But at the same time, I've tested those limits, and I've often been rebuffed. And I think the aspect of censorship that's not talked about much, because the right, the libertarian right in particular, has managed to classify censorship as something that only happens when the government or a government agency tells a media outlet not to run something or to change what they've written. But economic censorship is really the biggest enemy, usually, for people like me. When you have a voice or an opinion that people want to hear and are interested in hearing and would absolutely be interested in, but it's not being permitted, you're not being hired because of your politics or because that it's viewed that would offend people in the system. So there's normally someone, for example, in my particular stage in my career with the awards that I have, with the resume that I have, probably could be expected historically to be in a variety of media outlets that I'm not in, and I probably would be in them if my politics were not quite as far left. So I think that's the economic censorship, and I don't think it affects just the left, by the way, but it just happens to be my situation, and it's something that is really common. It is censorship if you should be hired somewhere and you're not.
Well, Ted Rall at Project Censored, we couldn't agree more. We talk about corporate media censorship a lot of the time. In fact, that's most of what we discuss in our top stories every year. And the definition of censorship, of course, we really expanded it. And you just described a very similar definition. And it's anything that interferes with the free flow of information in a society that purports to have a free press or free speech structure. And you're being singled out in some cases. Of course, we had you on the show over a year ago when there was certainly some controversy surrounding your depictions of President Obama in cartoons. But most recently, you've been involved in some very serious types of censorship, economic censorship, involving the Los Angeles Times, where you were an editorial cartoonist. Do you want to talk a little bit about that story as a case study?
Yeah, sure. Well, of course, it's all consuming at this point. So I just want to sort of walk people through the story in a linear, chronological way, and I promise it's not boring. It's worth hanging on. The story really begins in 2001 with a jaywalking arrest in Los Angeles. I was walking back from a taping of Bill Maher with Politically Incorrect to meet some friends for dinner on Melrose Boulevard in the West Hollywood section of L.A. when a motorcycle police officer indicated that I had jaywalked, which was false, completely false. And then he proceeded to handcuff me, pushed me around a little bit, but handcuffed me, shoved me up against the wall, and made me wait there while he wrote out a ticket. This attracted some passersby. It was kind of a punky neighborhood at the time. And they came and people gathered around and were questioning what the officer was doing. And some of them even were insulting him. And then ultimately he issued the ticket, released me, handed back my driver's license, and he said, here's your driver's license back, but instead of giving it to me, threw it on the ground. And it should just be pointed out as a foreshadowing device here in telling this story that he was whistling the entire time, and there was a huge disjunct between the jaunty way he was talking to me and the sort of thuggish way that he was treating me physically, which was very odd. I couldn't really understand it, but it will become clear why that was later on. So skip forward to 2009. I had been doing cartoons through syndication for the LA Times since the early 90s, but in 2009 they brought me on as a freelancer to do one cartoon a week about California and Los Angeles issues. Then a few years later I was asked to contribute a blog to go with the cartoon. And I did, and there's a little bit of extra money. That was my arrangement until July of this year. I was doing one blog and one cartoon a week. The blog usually just expanded upon the story that the cartoon was about and perhaps talked about the inspiration and my thinking behind the cartoon. On May 11th of this year, my cartoon was about a new jaywalking crackdown in L.A., I personally think that jaywalking is not really a crime, and if it is a crime, it's not a very serious one. I don't know that it merits more than perhaps a $5 ticket. But the LAPD was slapping $197 fines and charging some people with misdemeanors for jaywalking, which leaves you with a criminal record. And so having had my own experience back in 2001, I started off my blog with three or four paragraphs about my experience in 2001. And I just explained it pretty much the way I just explained it, but you can find it. It's still on the LA Times website. So that was that. A couple months went by. And then on July 23rd, I received a call at my home in New York from a Paul Pringle, who eventually identified himself as a reporter for the LA Times. And he had a lot of harsh interrogating questions that boiled down to the LAPD was challenging my version of events and said that what I had said about the circumstances of my arrest were untrue. They said that there was never any crowd, that there was never anyone angrily yelling at the cop. I was never handcuffed. I was never pushed around. He never threw my driver's license on the ground. And moreover, they said, we have proof of this. LAPD has evidence of that, and they've given it to us. And that evidence is an audio tape that the cop was surreptitiously making that entire time. So, in other words, unbeknownst to me back in 2001, and I think probably to many other Angelenos, the LAPD, at least many, it wasn't mandatory, but many LAPD officers were recording their stops with microcassette recorders. So Mr. Pringle asked me a lot of questions about my story and kept asking me the same questions multiple times, the way a police detective might ask you. And he said some interesting things. He said that the officer claims to have never handcuffed anyone in his entire career. And I asked how long he's been on the force. He said 20 years. And I'm like, really? He's an LAPD officer who's never... I wanted to say, like, that's, not even with your loved ones?
That's a rare specimen.
But, yeah, I was like, wow, he's either the best cop in the world or a total slacker. I'm not sure which. And then he said... And he said some other things that were curious, too. He said that I asked him how many complaints there had been from Internal Affairs about this particular officer. And he said, oh, only 5. I said, how does that stack up with the average? And he said, minuscule. And I have to say, it just didn't ring true that he would even have the answer to that question so handy. And he was very aggressive, though. He clearly didn't believe me and was accusing me of lying. And he said, look, the cops say they looked into this. They said they tried to call you because I had filed an Internal Affairs complaint back at the time in 01. But as I wrote, they ignored me. They didn't get back to me. I checked in. I never got a chance to say my piece, and they just ruled that it was unjustified, which is what they almost always do with all these complaints, like 98 to 99% of the time. In fact, they only deem 1.6% of complaints to Internal Affairs to be legitimate. So I think personally, by the time you complain to Internal Affairs, the odds are you're probably pretty angry, so maybe they're not all valid, but I bet it's more than 1.6%. Anyway, I was disgusted at the time, and so he said, you know, we have this tape, and it definitely validates the police's story and not yours. The police are saying that the officer, whose name is Will Durr, was extremely polite, and what you hear on the tape is a polite interaction, at the end of which I even ask him, like, hey, do you know any place to eat around here? So they're like, I don't know what you're complaining about. You had the nicest interaction in the world, and so, you know, you made this up. I get a call afterwards from Nicholas Goldberg, who's the editorial page editor of the LA Times. He asks me, Ted, what's going on? He didn't know. He wasn't in the loop. And later on, this struck me as very odd, because he supervises the section of the paper, the opinion pages, where my work appears. And so why would he not know what's going on? But he plainly didn't. So then I received a second phone call that same evening on Thursday, the 23rd of July, from Paul Pringle. And Pringle wanted me to listen to the tape, the audio tape that they had. So he emailed it to me by Dropbox. And I went home and, after a few unsuccessful attempts, managed to listen to it with him on the phone. And as I listened, you could hear Officer Durr speaking a little bit for about 20 seconds. And then you just hear 6 minutes of noise. You hear...
Static.
You just can't hear anything. If you go to anewdomain.net or rawl.com, I have the tapes embedded. You can listen to them there.
I'd like to just remind our listeners that you're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. We're speaking with Ted Rawl, and we're speaking about the state of free press. And Ted Rawl is now in the middle of talking about his recent experiences, what led up to his firing, what he says is his wrongful firing from the Los Angeles Times. So, Ted Rawl, please continue.
Sure. So the LA Times had sent me this audio tape that originated with the LAPD about my jaywalking stop, and it was 6 minutes and 20 seconds long, of which 20 seconds was barely audible, and 6 minutes is completely inaudible. Unless maybe perhaps if you're a dog, you could hear it, but I'm not a dog, so I couldn't, and nobody else, I don't know any dogs. So it was, there just wasn't anything there. And so I said to him, this is a joke. This is just unbelievable. How can you say that this confirms the cop story? So Pringle goes on and on about all sorts of strange questions. He says, well, we should be able to hear the driver's license hitting the ground. And I'm like, what? And he's like, yeah, well, you should be able to, why can't we hear the driver's license hitting the ground? And I'm like, because it's made of paper and we live on Earth. And anyway, this isn't exactly Steven Spielberg's boom mic, I remember saying. you just don't have like a lot of detail here. He's like, well, why don't we hear the handcuffs clicking on? I'm like, asked and answered, same exact reason, because you can't hear anything on this tape. How come we don't hear you arguing with the police officer? And I responded that was consistent with what I wrote in my piece, which was that I was polite and compliant, which is true, as I always am with police officers, because I'm afraid of them, because they can kill you, and they're scary. So it was very clear that he was looking to trip me up and get me to say, basically get me to admit that I was lying. Now, I wasn't lying. Everything went down exactly the way that I said back in 2001. It's why I filed an internal affairs complaint. It's why I've written about it in columns two or three times since then. I've been very angry about it. It's appalling. First, they ignore my complaint back in 01, and now they're using the same exact thing. They're lying again, this time to try to get me fired from the LA Times. It's unbelievable. And, you know, over a 14-year-old jaywalking stop, and they're lying on top of it.
And this is curious, Ted Rall. I want to remind listeners again that the story, you can find more, of course, at anewdomain.net, where you have a lot of this laid out. You can also go to rall.com, RALL.com. And again, so there's a 14-year gap here between this offense of jaywalking, and now the LA Times is dredging this up. And of course, that leads to another question we're going to get into, is how did they even bother to get this tape, or what caused this issue? But ultimately, what you're saying is 14 years later, the LA Times is using an excuse that you lied about jaywalking and they fired you?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, look, let's put this into perspective. I didn't lie, and for people who keep listening, I'm going to be able to prove it. But even if I had lied completely about the whole thing, most people who are familiar with journalism say I wouldn't have been fired. I might have gotten maybe a suspension for 30 days or something, a stern talking to, be careful, maybe a request that I lay off the police. But you're not going to be fired for this, and you're never going to be hung out to dry with a public statement the way that they ultimately ended up issuing in print and online. I mean, this was, look, the thing is, I went through my LA Times cartoons after I got canned, and I found at least 17 that are definitely could be viewed as extremely critical of the police and negative about police brutality, police killings of unarmed people, incompetence, just their general over-militarized thing. I mean, the LAPD is a very bad police force. I'm not telling any secrets here. So
right, from Rodney King on, I mean, we can go back, of course, way further than that. Yeah, Watts, etc. Well, let's get into this issue again about what's happening here with the LA Times and the LAPD and the police union. But first, we're going to take a brief musical break, and we will return with Ted Rall on the Project Censored Show. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. Today's program, we're looking at the state of the free press, the First Amendment. We're looking at censorship in American news broadcasting. And we have with us award-winning journalist and editorial cartoonist Ted Rall. And Ted Rall's newest book is out by Seven Stories Press. It's a biography of Edward Snowden, simply called Snowden. Now, Ted Rall, let's get back to the story of what happened at the LA Times with the LAPD and the Los Angeles Police Department Police Union. So go ahead, continue the story, please. Ted Rall.
Yeah, sure. This all went down on a Thursday, and on Friday I received an email saying that the Times was going to think about this over the weekend. As I later found out, that wasn't true. I filed my cartoon on Friday as usual, but the opinion page goes to bed on Friday afternoon. My cartoon should have then appeared on Monday, but it didn't, which means that at that point the decision had already been made to let me go. On Monday, I received a phone call from Nick Goldberg at 3 o'clock Pacific time, and he informed me that the next day the Times would be running an editor's note stating that because of discrepancies between my version of events and those in the LAPD provided audio tape, which they never had authenticated or investigated, and despite the fact that there's a political agenda, the LAPD knows that I don't like them, and they don't like me. Anyway, that because of those discrepancies, they were going to run this editor's note the next day, and as a result, they would no longer be using my stuff.
I just have to briefly interject. I can't help but notice, not a perfect analogy, of course, but I can't help but think of Gary Webb and the San Jose Mercury News and Jerry Seppos and just some of the flap there and the behind the scenes pressure and censorship and firing of Webb. But anyway, Ted, please continue.
People have pointed that out, and I thought about Gary too. It's just a pretty horrible place to be because it's bad to lose a gig. You know, look, I expected to lose the LA Times any second due to budget cuts or whatever. Cartooning is a very precarious profession in these times, and I'm lucky to have had the gig as long as I did. So I was expecting to get fired at some point, but I never expected it to be over a lie on behalf of the cops and that it was as a favor to the LAPD that I would be fired.
And the Times, I mean, are the Times editors implying that this confrontation over jaywalking undermines your work at the paper?
What they're saying in their editor's note is that I didn't tell the truth in my blog, that I said that I'd been handcuffed, but I hadn't, but there's no evidence that I had been. The license was thrown on the ground, but there's no evidence that it was, and that there was an angry crowd, but there's no evidence that there was. Now, it's pretzel logic, because it's guilty until proven innocent. I mean, the fact is, I don't need to provide an audio tape that says that all those things were true. They have to provide evidence that it's not true, and they could have probably provided that if they'd had a videotape, perhaps, of the scene, but they didn't, and they only had an audio tape. I mean, this is basically like, if you wanted an analogy for how audio tape doesn't tell the whole story. If you remember the scene in the movie A Clockwork Orange where Alex is singing in the rain while raping and murdering, you would not know without the visual what he was up to. You would just hear a man singing that old song. So this is the same thing. I mean, you just have a part. You're not going to hear a guy throw a driver's license on the ground. You're not going to hear a guy handcuff you or shove you up against a wall. You're just not going to. You can't. And that's assuming that the tape hasn't been manipulated, which the LA Times made no move to find out before firing me. So this went down on a Monday night. I spent all night. I knew this thing was going to come out the next day. So knowing how the internet works, I know people might come and Google my name and come to my blog to see if I had a response. So I spent all night writing a rebuttal to what I thought they were going to say about their logic. Look, it was a he said story. Nobody except me and Officer Durr really, and the other people there, really knew what happened that night. And, you know, that audio tape certainly didn't confirm my point of view, but it didn't confirm his either. So that was Tuesday. I published my rebuttal, and then I started receiving emails from people all across the country who said that they had expertise in audio analysis and were asking me to email them the LAPD WAVE file, digital version of this file, so that they could take a crack at maybe cleaning it up, CSI style. So I thought, whatever, and I went ahead and did it. And And I didn't expect anything to come from it, not really knowing anything about how this works, aside from liking music. I don't know anything about audio. So basically, I spent Tuesday and Wednesday very, very depressed. But then Thursday morning, I received a rough cut of an audio file, which had been cleaned up by an African-American man who lives in Los Angeles and therefore did not want to be identified because he feared retaliation by the LAPD. And he said, "Merry Christmas." And I looked in my inbox, downloaded the thing, and here is, from the tape, cleaned up. It's still crappy, but you can just barely hear an agitated woman say, "Take off his handcuffs." And so that's a pretty big hole in the LAPD's narrative. They said that I was never cuffed, and there were no angry witnesses there. But clearly there was at least one, and clearly I was cuffed. So at that point, it occurred to me, belatedly, to Google the officer's name. And there in the LA Times from May 2015, the same month that my blog appeared, was an article with that same cop making fun, quoted as making fun of a handcuffed suspect. This is the same cop who supposedly never uses handcuffs. But he's right there with a handcuffed suspect, the charge being aggressive driving, which in LA is actually considered is just a moving violation. And believe it or not, twisty-turvy, jaywalking is a misdemeanor. So actually, I was handcuffed for a more serious offense than the one that he was photographed in the LA Times. So the LA Times didn't even check their own website to see if this guy was straight up. So that was Thursday, and so I thought, okay, well, these are significant new facts. So I emailed them, I blogged about it, and I wrote about it at anewdomain.net. I then emailed the links and the new file information to Nick Goldberg, the editorial page editor at the LA Times, and asked him to reconsider his actions in light of this exonerating evidence that showed that at least that a very important part of my narrative was accurate and that the LAPD had in fact lied about me. There was no answer, which shocked me. I really expected them to get back because this is what newspapers do. I mean, newspapers make mistakes all the time, and then when they find out about them, they're supposed to retract them. And they should have just retracted and then brought me back on board. That's kind of the standard thing to do when you make a mistake like this. But no answer. So I kept contacting him, and then I realized, oh my God, these guys really don't care about the truth. They really don't care. So on Friday, I hired a post-production company in L.A. that works on Hollywood movies to clean up the tape, the whole 6 minutes and 20 seconds. And I paid them $1,200 because they'd had to work over the weekend, but time was of the essence, so I had them do this. And then on Sunday night, we got a transcript and also the new cleaned-up tape, and that tape suddenly opened up a lot of holes in the LAPD story. There are at least three, possibly four people shouting at the police officer. You can clearly hear "take off your handcuffs" at least twice. You can hear "take off his handcuffs." You can hear them questioning why is the cop bothering me with such a minor offense, given the fact that there's more important things going on in LA at the time. They're even making sexual comments about what he seems to be doing to me and making fun of his masculinity and manhood, and he's like talking back to them. So this was, I hate to say this, it's a crazy story, but it's as close to exoneration as you can probably get. Now, granted, I should never have had to exonerate myself. I shouldn't have been guilty until proven innocent. The burden of proof was always supposed to be on LAPD and LA Times to say that I had done something wrong. But here, I used the LAPD's own evidence tape to show that, in fact, I was the one who I really did prove that I was innocent. So at this point, I truly expected Goldberg to do the right thing. But again, I posted and blogged about it, and I emailed him and the editorial board and never heard back, ever. So they clearly were just, "We don't care, just go away." Now, by this point, the tide of public opinion has started to turn on social media. And there's a storm of tweets and Facebook posts discussing this matter. And people just don't understand why the Times hasn't reversed course and why they've left their editor's note up, which, you know, was defamatory in the first place and based on strange logic and taking the cops, of all people, the LAPD, at their word. But on top of that, you have no, like, just no communication. They're not even getting back to say, yeah, we're not going to do anything. There's just la, 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 we can't hear you.
Well, they didn't respond for quite some time.
3 weeks. They let 3 weeks go by without responding.
So they responded Wednesday, the 19th of August.
That's right. Exactly. Wednesday, the 19th. So they were really in lockdown mode. In fact, people were posting comments on the editor's note. These are paid subscribers to the LA Times. And they were so flooding in, so positive for me, that the LA Times shut down the comments and then started deleting those that were in my favor.
So further censorship at the LA Times. And where is the ombudsman? I mean, where are these people?
Well, we'll get to the ombudsman. I guess we're going to get to the ombudsman. She wrote the...
That's why I had to bring her in.
Yeah, she's a poor excuse for an ombudsman, to be sure. So that was it. And so I've been, over the last 3 weeks, trying to get some attention. Look, lawsuits are expensive and time-consuming and very exhausting, and I was kind of hoping to just get them to do the right thing. All I wanted was a retraction, an apology, and my $300 a week gig back. That's all I wanted. And I felt that it's worth more than any amount of money is to get if my cartoons are put back in the paper week after week after week. People might not see the apology or the retraction when it first came out, but they're going to see my cartoon in there, and that's all the validation that I need. And that's all I want. I just want to go back to drawing comics. So I've really dragged my feet on trying to do any legal action. I want to be careful. I want to just make sure that I'm giving them the space and every opportunity to do the right thing. But I'm beginning to see now that they probably don't have any ability to do the right thing due to the politics of how this all came together. So we can discuss that, too. But we should get to the response, which just came in on the 19th.
Before we do that, just wanted to remind listeners, you're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. We're speaking with Ted Rall, editorial cartoonist and author, and he is in the middle of explaining the recent controversy in Los Angeles regarding the Los Angeles Times, the Los Angeles Police Department, another element that we'll be getting into here momentarily, the Los Angeles Police Protective League. And Ted Rall, you're going to talk to us a little bit more right now about what's going on inside the paper. Go ahead.
Before I do that, I just want to talk about the response that the LA Times finally put out. So the ombudsman is named Deirdre Edgar. I hope I'm pronouncing her name right. And she, on the 19th, published a very long piece stating why the Times would not be taking me back and would not apologize. And obviously they're feeling the heat from the press and from social media. They've trashed their reputation with this decision about me. People see what they've done. And so they're feeling defensive. And so basically, if you read it, it's like very lawyerly and probably may have been written mostly by lawyers. I have reason to believe that. She says she only wrote the little introduction at the top. And it's essentially like this long stretching out the chewing gum where they just say the same things as they said before in the editor's note, but they add in some gratuitous comments about how, for example, I don't care for police officers. Yeah, it's like, no fooling. I don't care for policemen. I said that before. You know, most people don't. Most people, when they see the flashing lights in the rearview mirror, don't celebrate and say, yay, I get to meet a cop. So it's more of the same. They've really doubled down. And I think I may know why, but it's a very weird and interesting situation. But I think I should talk a little bit about, I mean, the big question is, of course, what's the origin of this tape? Where'd it come from? And who brought it from LAPD over to the Times? And who received it at the Times? And who ordered Paul Pringle to investigate? And who made the decision to fire me?
Those are fantastic questions. Let's get into that.
Anybody who's ever had like a car accident or any kind of crisis knows that you end up replaying traumatic moments and conversations in your head. And I've been doing that a lot over the last few weeks. And that's been helpful in a way because I've been able to piece together with the help of other smart friends of mine and allies what we think happened. And so the first question was, who was in the loop at the paper? Well, I called up the deputy editorial page editor, Susan Brenneman, on the Monday of the morning that I'd been fired. She was out of the loop. She hadn't attended any meetings of the editorial board about this. That's very curious, because when you fire a cartoonist at a newspaper, that's an editorial board decision. We're talking about deputy editorial page editors, editorial page editor, possibly the editor-in-chief, and they get together and discuss these things. But she wasn't in the loop. Now, the other deputy editorial page editor, who is my usual direct supervisor, Cherry G., she was on vacation in Japan for 3 weeks. I don't believe they would have brought her into the loop, and they certainly didn't talk to Susan. So that kind of leaves them out. And then I realized that Nick Goldberg, the editorial page editor, when he called me after I talked to Paul Pringle, the investigative reporter, didn't know what was going on. He was asking me what's going on. He was trying to get up to speed, which means he didn't sic Pringle against me. So now you're working your way up the food chain. And now, as for the next part, there's no reason to think that the editor-in-chief, Maharaj, had anything to do with this, because he doesn't supervise me. He's completely out of this loop, and there's no interaction between him and my position in any way, shape, or form. And so what that really leaves, then, the only other person it could be by process of elimination, I mean, look, this is speculation, okay, so who knows? It could be the sports department. It could be Dear Abby. I don't know. It could be Ziggy. But point is, it's...
As a cartoonist, you've got to watch out for Ziggy.
I guess Ziggy's a dangerous man. He's so round. So I thought, it does seem to point to Austin Buettner, who's the multimillionaire investment banker, publisher of the LA Times, appointed fairly recently, last year. And he took over the reins under the new regime of the Tribune Publishing Company. He's a former deputy mayor of L.A., so he's a political animal. And there's rumors that he's very interested in running for mayor next year. And his main political ally in the city of Los Angeles, that's also a rumor, is the police union, the Los Angeles Police Protection League, the LAPPL. So it seems like he would be the place to start if you were launching an investigation of who is behind this, who received it. And then working backwards, you have to kind of wonder, well, where does the tape originate? Where's the tape and the other supporting evidence, including my original complaint and the ticket and so on? Where do those come from? Well, we have to just speculate, because the Times isn't saying. They will not be transparent. They are not saying who did it.
And there's great irony there, given that this is a newspaper. This is supposed to be, they're supposed to be upholding great standards for evidence and transparency. They are talking about justification for firing part of their staff. One would think they would have to have pretty bulletproof evidence here, no pun intended, with police. But, you know, it seems as though they're falling flat on their face. We're speaking with Ted Rall, editorial cartoonist and author, and we will continue this conversation and get more in to the Los Angeles Police Protective League and some of the connections there to the LA Times after this brief musical break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. Today on the program, we're looking at a case study in media censorship and corporate or economic censorship of information and perspective in the United States. We're speaking with Ted Rall, and Ted is in the middle of telling us about his recent interactions and what recently took place here this past summer at the LA Times, where he was fired from being a cartoonist, and he's going through a lot of details. You can follow more of them at Rall.com, R-A-L-L.com, and anewdomain.net, anewdomain.net. Now, Ted, just before the break, we were getting into this, the LAPPL organization, and it's also the case that you have discovered that there is an $18.4 billion LAPPL pension fund, which is managed by something called Oak Tree Capital.
And that's right.
Oak Tree happens to be the single largest stockholder of the Tribune Publishing, the parent company of the Los Angeles Times. So perhaps that's a place we can springboard to continue your narrative.
Yes. I mean, the question that I had and a lot of other people have is, why did the paper take the cops at their word? Why did the paper fire me essentially as a favor to the police simply because I didn't like my cartoons criticizing police brutality? And why would they not do basic journalistic due diligence? I mean, if I brought an audio tape to any editor and said, this audio tape shows that Mickey Huff did blah, 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 they would say, okay, well, prove it. Have the tape analyzed, make sure that it's authentic, and see if you can get anything off it, any additional information off of it. They didn't do that. That's really journalism 101. And we're talking about Paul Pringle, who is a George Polk Award investigative reporter. That's really something that you would do in college paper. So why didn't he do that at the LA Times? I think we know why. There's this very cozy connection between LAPD via the pension fund, the LAPPL, Oak Tree Capital, and Tribune Publishing, the parent company. And it kind of goes further than that, too. This is a little bit circumstantial, but I'd say only a little bit. Back in 2009, the same union, the LAPPL, which at that time also had an F in it because the firemen were in it, the firemen have gone their separate way. The LAPPL union, predecessor union in 2009, run by the same people, they issued a threat in the LA Times against the editorial board of the San Diego Union Tribune. And that threat was based on the fact that at that time, the pension fund had just purchased $30 million of stock in the parent company of the San Diego Union Tribune, and they said that now that they, quote, owned the paper, they had the right to hire and fire members of the editorial board who are just hacks, they're just opinion makers, and because they're not pro-cop enough. Now, there's mixed reports on whether they succeeded in doing that. Some people say they got rid of half the board, other people say they got rid of all the board, some people say there's some evidence missing. We don't know, really, if they managed to pull that off or not. But certainly that was something that they said publicly to the LA Times, of all places. It's still a live link on the LA Times website, and that said that they wanted to do that. So it's clear that we're talking about a pension fund that's run by people who want to exercise political influence over the editorial direction of newspapers. I mean, let's face it, you buy Tribune Company stock. Tribune is a terrible stock. It's print media. You don't have to be, you know, the Wolf of Wall Street to know that print journalism isn't exactly tearing up the profits on Wall Street. The stock has been a constant downtrend ever since the LAPPL bought it, which I think is unconscionable misuse of pension dollars of retired police officers. It's fraud, really, and it should be illegal. And what they did is they pushed this influence around. So how does it go? Does someone from the police union call Austin Buettner and say, listen, we need you to do us a favor and get rid of Ted Rall because we hate his cartoons. And, oh, by the way, we have this tape. But don't look too closely, because if you do, you might find things you don't like. But they didn't check their tape very well. They were kind of stupid. And then after I was fired, the LAPPL published a statement saying, LAPPL applauds the firing of cartoonist Ted Rall by LA Times. And in this kind of thuggish, thinly veiled threat post, they said, let this be a warning to any other journalist who would mess with us. Do not criticize cops, otherwise.
Just to get the timeline for listeners, this cropped up somewhere in May and you were fired in July?
Yeah, and that brings up some questions, too. Like, what took so long? I have a theory about that, too. But again, since the Times isn't answering any questions, we're left to.
Well, they're certainly
piece
fomenting.
The pieces
together. Yeah, they're fomenting this, and you, by the looks of it, the Times doesn't appear as though they're poised or they're on the verge of coming clean here.
No, they seem to be covering up. That's one of the reasons I also think if this were coming from a lower level individual like Nick Goldberg, that they could just cut him loose and say he made a mistake and like suspend him or fire him and let him go. But when you see an organization behaving in this kind of like complete blockade mentality, it sort of points to the very top because they can't get rid of the guy at the top. He is the guy at the top. So even if everyone at the entire paper thinks he's wrong and crazy, he's there. And so I think that's kind of what's going on here. Now, I doubt that Buettner knew that the tape was basically faulty, flawed, may have been spliced. There's some indication that it was altered. Not least, there's some clicks on it that are suspicious, and also, it's real short. It's an arrest that lasted 6 minutes and 20 seconds. I mean, have you gotten a parking ticket have you ever gotten a speeding ticket and had it take 6 minutes and 20 seconds? I'd be surprised. There's things missing. There's things I know are missing. But he probably didn't look too closely at it. He's not a journalist. He's an investment banker. And I bet he's the one who called Paul Pringle personally and probably really freaked him out. And that would explain why, you know, a low-level reporter gets a call from the publisher and maybe he's not going to do his due diligence and have the tape checked out. So because he's excited and scared at the same time. And he's a few years away from retirement, just doesn't want to mess anything up. And I think it kind of falls in neatly to place. Now, to make things even murkier, though, the LA Times statement that was released by the ombudsman on Wednesday, the 19th of August, which was not by her own, it's signed by her, but it's not written by her. I don't know what kind of paper that is that does this. She says throughout that it's the LAPD that released the tape, not the union. But it may be that either that's true or the two things are so intermingled that they can't tell the difference and don't separate them. But I think that what we're really looking at is, I think it's the union for a couple of reasons. I think the question number one, why would you have a 14-year-old jaywalking tape, even though I did file a complaint at the time? It's a long time to keep something so trivial. The other thing was the nature of the copy of the documents. The documents are clean copies, and according to what I've heard, they were still using microfiche in 01. And microfiche is dirty and smudgy, so it doesn't really look like that. But, you know, unless that's not true. So there's so many questions. I mean, was this LAPD proper? Was this LAPPL? Did they have the right to release this stuff? Obviously, they had a political agenda. If I'd been drawing cartoons in favor of the police and they discovered that I'd lied about this, I doubt that they would have slipped this over to them.
Well, Ted Rall, in your estimation, what literally is the genesis of this 14 years later? Let's say that it is coming from the LAPD. I mean, you clearly suspect LAPPL, but why would it be sent to the LA Times?
Well, I think you have to look at what is in that LAPPL blog post. I think the motive was twofold. First of all, they wanted to get rid of a cartoonist whose work had been a thorn in their side for years. And secondly, they wanted to send a message to other reporters and journalists to not mess up, to not do the same thing, not mess with them.
So just one day, somebody at the LAPD or LAPPL just decides 14 years later to send a tape over to somebody at the LA Times?
No, I don't think that's how it went. No, I don't think so. I think what happened is that on May 11th, when my blog post appeared, they realized, oh, he filed an internal affairs complaint, which means we have it still in our files. Mm-hmm. So they went down to their file, whether it was at the union or at the PD, looked under R and found me there, Ted Rall. And then they pulled the file, and then they were like, huh, let's listen to this tape. Let's look at this transcript. It's like, wow, well, you know, this certainly sounds like more like a polite interaction, kind of like he lied. Or maybe the tape didn't really sound like a polite interaction, and maybe they did some splicing and dicing before they walked it over to the Times.
So remind listeners again back to the beginning of this story. I mean, at what point did you allegedly lie, and how did that happen at the LA Times?
Yeah, well, they said that in my blog post in May, when I was writing about my 2001 arrest for jaywalking, or maybe detention would be the right word, but I was handcuffed, so it felt like an arrest to me. They claimed that the way I described the police officer as being rude and unprofessional
Yeah, that was inaccurate. Yes, I hear. Yes.
I mean, you know, like I said, even if they were right, which clearly they were not, about me lying about that, is that really a fireable offense, really, for a journalist? I mean, like, especially
later,
when nothing's ever happened before, you know, we're talking about, mm-hmm. I talked to Nick Goldberg, and I asked him, hey, you know, has my work ever, the veracity or integrity of my work, ever been called into question before? And he said, no, it hasn't. So given that right. fact, mm-hmm. you would think that they'd say, like, well, this is probably not really firing. And if it's firing, it certainly isn't burn notice worthy, where you post something onto, you know, you print a notice in the paper basically telling the rest of American journalism to never hire this person because he's a fabulist and a liar.
Yeah, blacklisting. It sounds, well, it certainly looks suspicious and sounds like a hatchet job.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, they certainly didn't do a due diligence. Oh, I left out one little thing, because there's so many moving parts to this. But on the 19th, they finally, due to the pressure from the internet, they say, well, we did hire some audio experts. And I'm like, well, better late than never, I suppose. And they say, well, they can't really hear the word handcuffs. And then one of them is kind of a guy who just does audio tech stuff on the side. And then the other one's a real guy, but he says he can't hear it. But some of the assertions are laughable. Like, they say, well, you know, there's a conversation in the background, but it seems to be unrelated. So we're being asked to believe that, you know, when you see someone getting a ticket on the street by a cop, that if you gather nearby, you could be talking about something else. I don't know about you, but if I were talking about a movie or something, I'd be like, cop giving ticket, step away. And if you're near the cop, you're paying attention and you're discussing what's going on with the ticket. I mean, that's just human nature. That's ridiculous. And but he also said, well, you know, my transcript was not correct. Well, I mean, that could be true. If one word is off, that could be true. So,
right.
But, I mean, so it's just they're threading the needle very, very carefully in a lawyerly way. But you can tell that they really don't know what they're doing. And, you know, they don't really have anything. They know they're in a bad place. They really should just retract and apologize. I think they're afraid of the legal exposure. But they should just do the right thing. I'm perfectly happy to put this behind me. I'm just looking for what I'm owed, which is an admission that they're wrong.
And Ted Rall, again, listeners can go to rall.com, R-A-L-L.com, or anewdomain.net, where all of this is documented and linked in detail. So, Ted Rall, we have a few minutes left. And how can listeners maybe be involved, not just learn more at these websites, but what might you suggest people could do in your assistance? I know cartoonistsrights.org has stepped up and done some work. Certainly Project Censored and Greg Palast have kind of spread the word about what's been happening here. What are your thoughts on that in the last couple minutes we have here?
Yeah, thanks for asking that, Mickey. Well, I mean, first and foremost, I don't want people to just reflexively say, oh my God, Ted Rall is being screwed over. I like his cartoons. I want to defend him. I really want people to understand that I'm not telling the 85% truth, I'm telling the 100% truth and about this incident, and that the LA Times has completely railroaded me. And I want, toward that end, I want people to go to anewdomain.net and rawl.com, and probably rawl.com is the easier place to start where the links are, and just listen to that tape. Listen to the enhanced tape and listen to the LAPD tape. And when you listen to the LAPD tape, ask yourself, can you really tell what's going on? Because that's the tape that they fired me on. This tells us that driver's license was not thrown on the ground. This tells us there was no angry crowd. This tells us that you were never handcuffed. Can you tell those things from listening to the LAPD tape? And then also listen then to the enhanced tape and say, well, does this tell me that maybe he was handcuffed? Does this tell me that there was a crowd? Does this tell me he might have been pushed around? Just use your own critical thinking. And if you agree with me, then, I mean, if you agree with them, the LAPD, that I deserve to be fired in the LA Times, then, you know, God bless you, go and write them a letter of support. But if you agree with me that they lied and are railroading me and that it's really dangerous for democracy to have the police in charge of the editorial decision-making process of the third or fourth largest newspaper in the United States, then I want you to write to the LA Times and demand what you think ought to be done. And also to write, this is probably more important, write to reporters and journalists at other progressive media outlets and mainstream corporate media outlets, write to the Washington Post, write to Jim and Romanesco, write to Amy Goodman at Democracy Now, and ask that they take a look at this story. Because the one thing that's really killing me and killing the free press, or killing press freedom, is the obscurity that these stories can languish under. Lack of coverage is what's allowing this to happen.
I couldn't agree more, Ted Rall, and that's exactly why we wanted to have you on the Project Censored show this week. And I know I mentioned earlier to listeners we were going to talk about your new book, Snowden, which ironically is about the other kind of censorship that we started the show talking about, that would being, you know, government kinds of censorship. We've spent the hour talking about corporate economic censorship from one of the biggest papers in the U.S. and the connections to LAPD and police union. And again, at Project Censored, that's really the kind of censorship we end up talking about a lot more in the United States. Not that there isn't other kinds that your book Snowden, just now out on Seven Stories Press, goes into, but we'll have to have you back another time to talk in detail about that book.
Just one little note. If the cops are involved, it is a First Amendment case. It is government censorship.
Yes, indeed. You're correct. It's a combination, and it certainly is not the 1-2 punch that you're looking for. So, Ted Rall, thank you so much for being with us on the Project Censored show today.
Thank you, Mickey. I really appreciate it.
We want a liberated land, supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own my special interest.
That's our program for today. Thanks so much for joining us. The Project Censored Show airs on 25 stations around the U.S. For more information and to listen to archives of previous shows, go to www.projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. Anthony Fest is our producer, Erica Bridgman, our engineer. I'm Mickey Huff. We'll see you next time.
Victualized, alibis, disguised under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys. And the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. And the times for the master thief, confine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu.